I think I'm going to try and speak without a microphone, but if anybody can't hear me clearly, please indicate. Can everybody hear me okay? First of all, I'd like to add my support to all the people in Nottingham who are campaigning against these cuts. You know, I absolutely support you in your struggle against our Labour Council, that's making these cuts. It stands completely against everything that Labour once used to stand for. And I would urge the Council to reconsider and to stick up for all the local communities here, not just the gay community, the black community, women, the disabled community, Muslims. Everybody in the city deserves quality services, and we should not be going down the road of implementing Thatcher-style cuts on the weak and vulnerable. The main theme of my talk today is about the global struggle for LGBTI human rights. And it strikes me as absolutely, well, almost unbelievable that here we are in the 21st century and still today not a single major international human rights convention gives protection and recognition to LGBTI people. Universal Declaration of Human Rights does not explicitly and specifically give protection against discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation or gender identity. Nor does any other major human rights convention. Even the European Convention on Human Rights itself, Article 14, the clause that guarantees equal rights and non-discrimination, does not include in that text any mention of sexual orientation or gender identity. I can remember way back in the 1980s, there were several cases brought by British LGBTI people to challenge the European Convention, to make the claim that the unequal age consent, then 21 for gay and bisexual men, compared to 16 for heterosexual couples, but that was contrary to the principles of non-discrimination in the European Convention. Because the European Convention, Article 14, it specifically says that discrimination is based on gender, race, language, marital status, and so on. All these things are specifically declared unlawful. And there is a clause, which finishes, which talks about all other status. And the LGBTI claimants went to the European Court of Human Rights in the 1980s to argue that other status should include sexual orientation and gender identity. So they brought a case against the unequal age consent. They brought a case against the non-recognition of the foreign partners of British lesbian and gay people under immigration law. They brought a case under the Mental Health Act about next of kin rights and visiting rights. They brought a case under the European Convention against the ban on lesbian and gay people serving the armed forces, arguing this clause, other status, should apply to sexual orientation. Every single one of those cases was lost. Every single one. They were all ruled inapplicable and rejected. Thankfully, of course, some nearly two decades later, finally in 1999, the European Court of Human Rights did rule in a case brought by four lesbian and gay military personnel that the ban on homosexual people serving the armed forces was unlawful. And that is what forced the government, the then government Tony Blair, to end the ban and to allow lesbian and gay and bisexual personnel to serve openly in armed forces. That was the first time that the European Court of Human Rights had ruled that this clause, other status, could be interpreted to include sexual orientation. then it followed up very soon afterwards with a similar judgment, also declaring illegal the unequal age of consent. So those two major reforms in British law have come about through the interpretation of the European Convention as outlawing discrimination based on sexual orientation. But even now, that Article 14 does not state that sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination are unlawful. It's all based on the interpretation of that clause of the statement. We saw a similar sort of interpretation when it came to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and in particular the United Nations Convention on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Again, nothing in this convention gives explicit specific protection on the grounds of sexual orientation or gender identity. But back in 1994, in a case brought by gay men in the Australian state of Tasmania, the United Nations Human Rights Committee ruled that the general equality clause, the general non-discrimination clause of this convention should apply to sexual orientation, and therefore declared the Australian state of Tasmania's total ban on male homosexuality, then punishable by a maximum sentence of 21 years jail, declared it unlawful. So the gains we have won have not been based upon any international human rights convention explicitly and specifically acknowledging protection and equality for LGBTI people. They've been based on interpretations of those clauses, interpretation of the general provision of equality and non-discrimination should be extended to our community. So it is, as I say, rather remarkable that that remains the situation even today. We know that around the world there are about 80 countries that continue to criminalise homosexuality, mostly male homosexuality, but sometimes female homosexuality as well. And the penalties range from just a few years imprisonment, right up to life imprisonment in countries like Bangladesh and Uganda. And as has been previously mentioned, there are several countries that still have the death penalty, where it's a capital crime to have same-sex relationships. Even in the Commonwealth, which is founded on the principles of democracy and human rights, of the 54 member states of the Commonwealth, 46 still outlaw same-sex relations in all circumstances. 46 out of 54 totally criminalise same-sex relations. And Skye and myself, with others, have been to see the Commonwealth Secretariat to raise our objection to the way in which the Commonwealth talks about democracy and human rights, but has failed singularly to ever speak out against the abuse of the human rights of LGBTI people. I've gone through all the records. I've never seen a single example where the Commonwealth has ever condemned the abuses against LGBTI people by Commonwealth member states who signed up to the principle of equality, non-discrimination, and the protection of human rights. We tried to have meetings with the Commonwealth Secretary General, Kamala Sharma. He won't meet us. He's not even prepared to meet us. We've asked him to publicly condemn those countries that criminalise and persecute the LGBTI citizens. He refuses. He refuses. Now, there are people in the Commonwealth Secretariat's Human Rights Unit who do support our struggle, but they have very little power. We met Perna Sen, the head of the Commonwealth Human Rights Union, and we're going to meet her again in September. But she's been quite frank. She's just a lowly civil servant. And the political masters, the head of the Commonwealth, and his key people are not willing to speak out against the abuses against LGBT people. Even when Stephen Thorongé had been arrested and sentenced to 14 years in imprisonment with hard labour in Malawi, the Commonwealth Secretary General refused to speak out. I think it calls into question the credibility and indeed the value of the Commonwealth as an institution. If it's not prepared to speak out against gross human rights abuses, then what's the point of having the Commonwealth? If it can't uphold its own values, its own ideals, then the Commonwealth may just as well be useless. Skye has mentioned, of course, that so many of these anti-gay laws that exist in these countries were originally imposed by the British colonial administration in the era of imperialism. Virtually every anti-gay law that exists in a Commonwealth country originated as a British colonial law imposed on that country during the period of colonialism. If you look, whether it be India, or Nepal, or Zimbabwe, or Nigeria, time and time again you see that all those laws date back to the period of British colonial rule. So the idea that these are somehow authentic expressions of the people in these countries is a nonsense. Now, these laws were not devised by the people of Malawi, or Uganda, or Zambia, or Zimbabwe, or Nigeria, or wherever, they were imposed upon them. Together with, of course, the Christianizing missionaries who came with them. And it isn't just, of course, about the laws of this country. It is also about the deep-seated, fundamentalist interpretation of Christianity that go with it. Because although the laws were not devised by the peoples of those countries, many of those populations have embraced a very harsh fundamentalist interpretation of Christianity, which was exported to their countries by missionaries from Britain, and in particular, I've got to say it, no offense to Scots, but from Scotland. And a very harsh, you know, fundamentalist extreme form of Presbyterianism, mostly. And that mentality has remained very, 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 very strong. And it is somewhat ironic that we have in places like Africa, people there professing that homosexuality is un-African. And when you ask them, they often refer to their own Christian faith, which, of course, is entirely un-African. So there's lots of contradictions there. But then again, we must also say that there have been some very brave, heroic African Christian leaders who have spoken out against homosexuality. I think of, as you know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa. He has compared homophobia to racism. He said that he did not support the struggle against apartheid in order to maintain oppression against anybody in South Africa. But for him, this struggle was not just against racism, but also against all forms of oppression for the liberation of all African people. That's a very heroic stand, but he is, for the most part, a fairly isolated voice. I'd like to also pay tribute to Bishop Christopher Senyonjo of the Church of Uganda, part of the Anglican Communion in Uganda, who has been virtually a lone voice in that country, speaking out against the homophobic witch hunts, and in particular, the current anti-homosexuality bill. Bishop Senyonjo is a very old man. He's well into his 70s now. But he decided that it was his duty as a Christian to embrace and support the vulnerable, including and in particular LGBTI Ugandans. because he saw them as having so few allies, so few protectors, he felt it was his Christian duty to defend and support them. And so he spoke out against the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, against the arrest and harassment of LGBTI human rights defenders, against the government's decision to fine Radio Simba a huge sum of money for simply interviewing a lesbian activist on the program. Bishop Chimamanda spoke out against all these things. And as a result, he was relieved of his duty. He has been denied the right to preach. They've even taken away his pension. Even taken away his pension. When I say they, I'm talking about the Church of Uganda, a so-called Christian denomination, has taken away this man's pension. He's given his life service to the Church. And it's simply because he defended LGBTI Ugandans. He has now lost his pension and been effectively cast into the wilderness, disowned and ostracized by his own fellow churchmen. That's real courage. That's real guts. That's the kind of heterosexual defender that we need, appreciate, admire, and salute. Mention has been made of the case in Malawi, where Stephen Mjonza and Kibongi Chimbalanga were eventually sentenced to 14 years hard labour, even though there was no clear evidence or proof that they had had homosexual sex. It was all speculation by the judge. And the fact that he held them in detention for nearly 5 months without bail shows from the outset that judge's own bias. Because in Malawi, even armed robbers, rapists, and murderers often get bail. But these two men, who had harmed no one, were denied bail and held in the most horrendous conditions in Chichiri prison in Malawi for nearly 5 months. Chichiri prison is not like a prison that we know. People die there all the time from disease and lack of medical attention, from the effective enforced malnutrition because of the poor standards of prison food. Just two meals a day, a maize meal with a few beans, that's it, and a bit of water, that's all you get. If those guys had served their sentence, or, you know, the sentence had been carried out, I doubt they would have survived 14 years. Very few prisoners in Chichiri prison do. And I want to pay tribute again to another heterosexual friend and ally who helped make life so much more bearable for Stephen Tuwondo. And that man is George Findwa, the executive director of the Secular Association of Malawi. For those who don't know, back in the 1970s, I was very much involved in the campaign against the dictatorship of the Malawian leader, the President for Life, Hastings Banda, who had a draconian tyranny which resulted in the long-term imprisonment, in some cases execution, of peaceful, non-violent opponents. And George was one of them. He served time in Chichiri prison. And I managed to contact him, and he agreed, because I've got to say, no gay people in Malawi were willing to go to prison because they feared that they'd be picked on. So I asked George, and he agreed to act as a prison visitor, and from London, Outrage sent him money, which he was able to use to bribe prison guards, to allow visits, to allow letters to get in, to take in food. He sent him money, he bought clothes for these guys, because when they were taken, they had virtually no clothes on. Shoes, their shoes had been taken off them. Vitamin pills, all the kinds of things to make their life even more comfortable. And George is the real unsung hero of that battle to support Stephen and Toronto. a straight man, a full political prisoner, and because he was a full political prisoner, he knew how the prison system in Milan worked. He knew what he had to do, how to bribe people, how to get favours. He did it. A great personal risk. Great personal risk. In the end, he wasn't victimized, but he could easily have been. And many, many other people I approached in Malawi to do these crucial prison visits, they're just not willing to do it because they feared the consequences. But George did. And Stephen Kalonge say that those visits were absolutely fundamental in sustaining him, not only physically in terms of the food and the vitamins and the clothes for him, but most importantly psychologically. Because they felt so isolated in that prison. They were being abused and beaten by prison guards and by fellow prisoners. They were sharing, one was sharing a cell with 90 people. At night, you couldn't, there was no room to sleep down. You had to sleep, sitting up, or leaning, standing up or leaning against someone else. That's how many people were in these cells. And they felt so isolated. When they were going to court, they'd be abused and spat at and jeered. But they said that the messages that I managed to get smuggled in through George, and the messages they were able to send out, activating the campaign to support them, they said that was the emotional and psychological support that sustained them through those long 5 months. So I think it shows the importance of international solidarity. This isn't about rescuing or saving these people, it's about supporting them in their struggle, their fight for LGBTI freedom. And just like the international campaign against apartheid in South Africa is so important in giving hope and confidence and solidarity to the people in that country who are fighting for their freedom, so our global struggle for LGBTI freedom is so important to sustain people in weak, vulnerable positions in tyrannical countries where they often have very little support. That international solidarity can really, really make a difference. When I look back at battle in Malawi to get Stephen Kalonge through, I'm sort of half, because although what they went through was so terrible, as far as I know, it's the first time ever LGBTI prisoners have ever been released, let alone by a presidential pardon decree, anywhere in the world. I can't think of a single other case where a gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person who has been jailed has been released as a result of an international campaign. So I think that will really embolden us to say that we need to do more. And that if we do more, we can help more. That more people can be free. So that's an encouraging element or outcome of that battle to support those guys in Malawi. The other thing is that in many ways, I see LGBT activists in, say, Africa as continuing the African liberation struggle that was begun against colonialism. In the era of colonialism, people are fighting for the right to self-rule and self-determination, to have their own government, to elect their own leaders. A very important world historic struggle for freedom. Well, I see the LGBTI struggle as a continuation of that liberation struggle, extending the realms of freedom into those of gender identity and sexual orientation. It's about continuing the struggle begun by people like Kwame Nkrumah and others back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and extending it to other African people. I'm also heartened that in some parts of the world, there are small, tiny countries that are leading the way on LGBTI rights. I think of Nepal. In Nepal, we have an openly gay congressperson, Sunil Pal, who represents one of the Communist parties. He's also the leader of the LGBTI movement in Nepal. And his organization, and in particular him personally, has done so much to winnow and change the minds of the political leaders of all Nepal's post-monarchist political parties. Even the Maoists, who were traditionally quite hostile to LGBTI rights, seem to have now been won over. And several of the Maoist leaders who, as you know, were part of the government, or actually had controlled the government for some months before they stepped away, they have begun to make very positive and supportive statements in accordance with LGBTI human rights. A lot of that is down to the negotiation, the meetings, the discussions that Sunil has organized. He's now been so successful with his group, the Blue Diamond Society, that they are now moving towards discussing in the Nepal Parliament the possibility of legalizing same-sex marriage. That's how much progress has been made. So you've gone from a country ruled by absolute monarchy, where LGBTI people, in particular transgender people, were very, very heavily persecuted, to a situation now where LGBT rights is part of the human rights mainstream and is now being embraced by all the political parties from left, I'm going to say left to right, but it's really left to left. Not really the right-wing party, even, of course. I'm also incredibly encouraged by the fact that it was South Africa, after apartheid, that became the first country anywhere in the world to enshrine protection for LGBTI people in its constitution. For the first time, the post-apartheid constitution ensured protection against discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation. That had never happened in any other country in the world. And since then, South Africa has been followed by other unlikely countries like tiny Ecuador or Fiji. And I know that, of course, having a constitution, having that protection, it doesn't mean that everything's hunky-dory. But boy, what a step forward these countries have been able to put that in their new constitution to give us that recognition and protection. The final thing I'd say is that queer human rights, LGBTI human rights, they're not just for us here in Britain or Europe. They're not just for us in the West. They are for every human being on this planet. As Claire said, in different countries, the manifestations of gender identity and sexual orientation is different. And we should not rush to impose our Western models on other countries. But nevertheless, the fundamental of the right of people to make their own choices about their sexual orientation and about their gender identity, that is a universal principle. Whatever they call it, however they manifest it, these are fundamental human rights, just as much of the right to have your faith and profess it, just as much as the right to freedom of speech and the right to protest. And so, in the coming decades, I think we can be very confident that this movement that began not that many decades ago, from almost nothing, has become a worldwide movement and will continue to grow. The movement for LGBT human rights is unstoppable. You know, the tide of history is flowing our way. It's just up to us to give it a push, to make it flow faster.